Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Around the world, Muslims praise the Prophet Muhammad through the recitation of lyrical poetry. In West Africa, Arabic praise poetry has a rich history informed by local literary, spiritual, and ritual elements. Oludamini Ogunike explores this abundant heritage in poetry in praise of prophetic perfections, a study of West African Arabic Mahdi poetry and its precedents, published with Islamic Text Society in 2020. In this social setting, praise poetry draws from traditional Islamic materials, but also employs patterns and concepts from West African sources and practices. Ogunike translates numerous poems and contextualizes them within a deep intellectual well of Sufi thought. He also places these poems within the realm of lived religious practice and presents them as part of everyday contemporary life in West Africa. In our conversation, we discuss the place of praise poetry as a genre, the broader literary tradition it relies on, Sufi theology, the wider intellectual heritage of West Africa, Ibrahim Niass and the Tijaniya Order, audiences' recitation and readings, the functions of these poems in practice, the process of translation, and how these sources might be used in classrooms. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Now, without any further delay, here's my conversation with Oludamini Ogunike about poetry and praise of prophetic perfection. Welcome to New Books and Islamic Studies. Thanks for joining me today, Dom. I'm excited to talk to you about your beautifully written and beautifully looking book, Poetry and Praise of Prophetic Perfection. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I'm excited to get into it. It's always good to have new translations of materials, especially for teaching purposes. I think a lot of people would be able to use a lot of this material in their classes, but even just to kind of get introduced to how this tradition, both literary and spoken, gets played out in the West African tradition. I'm excited to hear more about it. But we typically begin with a little bit about what brought you to Islamic studies. So if there are particular mentors or moments or things that drew you to perhaps the topics you're interested in, the approaches you take, can you tell us a little bit about who, you know, how did you become the Islamic studies professor you are today?
It's kind of a long story. I initially started out in physics and then wound my way over to neuroscience. And my first degree is actually in neuroscience and African studies. And I came to Islamic studies through African studies. I was an undergrad at Harvard at the time, and I just started taking some African studies classes as electives and just totally fell in love with African studies and the different perspectives it provided. And on the kind of questions I've been asking before or related questions in physics and neuroscience, but it provided a different kind of critical angle on these things. And then within African studies, I became particularly enamored of Yoruba religious traditions, being Yoruba by myself, and then also Islamic traditions in Africa, particularly Sufism and the literature and the kind of philosophical and intellectual content there, really just grabbed me. And then it was difficult for my family a little bit to think that, we sent this kid to be a neuroscientist, and now he's gonna study, go back home, and we worked so hard to get here. But they eventually came around when they saw that you could actually make a career out of this and support a family and do good work. So I came to Islamic studies through African studies, and in particular, I have to credit the African American Studies Department at Harvard, where I did my undergrad and my PhD. A bunch of professors there, Jacob Olupona, the late Francis Abiola Irele, Biodun Jefo, and Usman Khan, especially, for sparking my interest and helping me develop my love of Islamic African materials and thought. And Professor Khalid Ruwayhib over in NELC at Harvard, I took an Arabic seminar with him and absolutely fell head over heels in love with Ibn al-Farid's poetry. So we studied one poem of his in the class, and I kept asking for more poetry because it was just some of the most amazing poetry I've ever read in my life.
This is it's great to always kind of get these background stories, because after reading the book, it really, this narrative kind of helps us see how all these threads come together, especially in this project. And from what I know of your other work, it sounds like in that as well. So for this, a lot of the work you do in this book is translation itself and making new, English renderings of Arabic texts that we generally don't have access to. So can you talk a little bit about, how did this project emerge for you? What motivated you to do it? You're very lucky that you have a job, but translations especially for emerging scholars is not often valued in the same way as other type of work. So can you talk a little bit about, like, how does this project fit into your other kind of academic endeavors, and what motivated you to want to do this?
Yeah, that's a great question. This project is interesting. It's actually an accidental project. I was doing research for what's going to be my other book, hopefully coming out this fall, on epistemology in West African Sufism. And while I was doing research in Senegal and in Nigeria, I kept hearing these amazing performances of people reciting poetry. And these are things I heard as a kid in Nigeria, but it didn't really register to me what they were. And then when I would interview people about, let's say, how did you come to join a Sufi tariqa, things like that, about a dozen people told me, oh, I heard the sound of these poems being recited, and they attracted me. And I came, just kind of walked over to see what was going on. Like, one guy told me, it's like I was coming out of a club in the morning, and I heard these poems, and I was like, wow, that's cool. So I just kind of wandered around the corner, and there were these guys sitting in a circle reciting these poems in this incredible melody. And so I sat down and talked to them about what's going on next week. I took the tariqa, and that was that. So this poetry just kept popping up, and it just, the kind of aesthetic beauty and musical beauty of it grabbed me first. And so then I started talking to some of the people who performed this poetry, some composers of this poetry. And then I noticed that these poems were being taught in these Sufi circles a lot, and that a lot of the kind of most interesting stuff, from my perspective, the stuff that I was most interested in terms of Sufi cosmology and epistemology and things like that, were in this, you could actually find them in the most clearest form in these poems. And so I just started for myself, just because I thought it was interesting, recording some of these poems, and started trying to translate some of them. And I wrote one paper, Presence of Poetry, Poetry of Presence, about one poem in particular that I really liked, and that was very popular amongst the community in Senegal. And I planned to make a kind of digital archive, a West African Sufi Poetry Project. And it was semi-academic, but it was mostly just recording, trying to get recordings and texts of very popular poems, just because I found them so aesthetically beautiful, and I've always had an interest in poetry. But the actual book manuscript came as a result of a paper I was writing for a conference at Harvard. And the paper just grew and grew and grew and grew. And I sent it to the conference organizer, who happened to be Professor Khan, my old advisor. And he said, this is great, but this is too long. He's like, this is a book length thing, you know, this is not a paper. So cut it in half for the conference. But, you know, you should consider publishing this as a book later on. So it really kind of came about accidentally. I was just writing a paper about this, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger until it came to be about book length. But the real origin of this is literally just the auditory, the aesthetic, the kind of musical experience of the poetry, and being attracted to that, and then hearing how other people were attracted to that.
If I only had the same problem, that I just keep writing, and I just end up with a book, if we were all so lucky. I was going to talk about this later on, but it seems related to kind of how you've been talking about this now. Many of the translations that you provide, you have a link to the recorded audio version of it. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how you imagine readers of the book might use the book in relation to these recitations, maybe even in the classroom. Have you thought about this, or perhaps what do you do in your own classrooms with these?
Yeah, exactly. So this also kind of came out of my classroom teaching experience. I mean, a lot of our students, and even us now, are very visually oriented, video oriented. And especially with teaching Islam in Africa to, you know, a bunch of kids in Virginia, having the visuals there, kind of the more immersive I can be, the better. But, I mean, sometimes I'll show people videos of Nigeria or something, and they're like, oh, people ride on motorcycles in Nigeria, or there are skyscrapers. I mean, it's wild, but, you know, this is the kind of stereotypes we have to deal with. So having these video things where they see people with their cell phones out, people dancing, people just walking by in the marketplace, but giving that kind of immersive experience that you get from YouTube clips is really good. So I've used them in my teaching. I mean, as long as I've been teaching Islam in Africa, the YouTube clips really help situate things in a way that would take, you know, pages and pages of, or, you know, hours of verbal explanation. But also the main thing for me is I hope readers and teachers who use this book will use the YouTube clips or other YouTube clips. I mean, there are a lot of great YouTube channels that just kind of specialize in performance of West African Madih poetry. They're great to teach with because there's something about the sound and the performance of it that even if you can't understand the lyrics, which, you know, many people, even many people who enjoy these poems in West Africa aren't fluent in Arabic. There's just something about the performance and the musicality of it that really brings it home in a way that it's tough to get on the page, and is even tougher to get with a translation. So I'm hoping that if you teach it, if you read it, you'll listen to the poems. When I was writing the book and doing the translations, I would play these poems a lot, like in the car when I was driving my son to daycare and stuff like that. And I found, as a result, accidentally, my son has a good section of this one Mauritanian poem by Ali Adali memorized, and this other poem as well, too. Those were his two favorites. He just loved to listen to them. So if we're driving to daycare, you'd be like, Daddy, play Al-Fusalati, or Daddy, play Salatul Rabbi. There's something very special about the performance of these as well that brings them to life. So I'm hoping that readers will become listeners, and that teachers will play these YouTube links and other YouTube links as well. Because the poems, I guess, kind of like the Quran. The Quran's kind of on this oral literary continuum, because it's a recitation. But it also has like letters in it: Kaf, Aleph, Lam, Mim, Kaf, Ya, Ain, Sad. So it's also written, and these poems also kind of exist on that oral literary continuum, and so there's really something special that you get when you engage with both its written form and its performed form.
This might be a good place to ask you a little bit about craft as well, in terms of doing the translation work. You know, many listeners are going to be working in translation as well. So can you talk a little bit about how you go about working on translating these texts? What strategies or process did you use? Are there different things that happen when you're dealing with different types, from the oral to the written?
I mean, different poems kind of hit me differently. So there's one poem that's very, very kind of a short lines, very musical. And the rhythm of that was so strong. Actually, I tried to write the translation in the same rhythm of that, like in the same kind of meter in English, because it was just so strong and so catchy. It kind of imposed itself on the translation. But generally, what I tried to do when I would translate is I would try to parse each bait, each verse, as literally as possible, and then look at the different possibilities of meaning. Because one of the things with poetry is that the poet's usually saying three or four things at the same time. You know, so there are several different ways you can parse each verse, and then you have to make a choice in translation. Or if you're really good, maybe you can capture two of the meanings by doing something like that. So I first just try to do as literal as possible of a translation, which was usually very clumsy, very awkward English. And then I try to go back and try to smooth it over and to make it a bit more readable English while still holding on to some of the literalness, especially with Arabic poetry. I think especially with Arabic Sufi poetry, maybe I should say, and this kind of Arabic Sufi poetry, it does a lot playing with the literal meaning of words. So it's like the famous joke about roots in Arabic is everything. Every root in Arabic means something, its opposite, and something having something to do with a camel. And it's really true. There are these kind of things that, hawa, love or passion or something like that, also can mean like the dive of a falcon from on high or something like that. And the poets, the really good poets, are kind of aware of these deep roots. So I go to like Lisan al-Arab and Lane and try to look up the kind of original, literal, you know, very kind of visceral meanings of these things, and try to kind of see the visceral, literal picture that the poets were painting and what they were doing with that. And I would try, where possible, to incorporate that into the translations and still make them kind of readable. But I've never been fully happy with any of my translations. I'll go back to them and go back to them and want to tweak it and do this and that. And that's one of the reasons, again, why I wanted to include the links, because you can read this translation in English and it doesn't sound so nice. I mean, it's okay. But hearing the way the poems are sung in Arabic gives you a real sense of the beauty and why these things can be so enchanting. So that was kind of the technique I used in translation. And then there'd be a few times where I'd get stuck on something and I'd call, usually WhatsApp, one of my friends in Senegal and Nigeria, who are more immersed in this tradition. And I say, hey, what's going on here? Do you think this reading of mine is correct? This and that. And sometimes they make suggestions and I'd agree with them. Sometimes I wouldn't. But having that kind of conversation with people who were even more steeped in this poetry was very helpful.
Now, the kind of aesthetic draw of this poetry is one kind of component of it. I mean, this is a specific genre. So perhaps you could kind of help us think about what this kind of praise poetry is all about. What are some of the essential characteristics and if there's anything else about poetry in general that you think makes it so resonant for many?
Yeah, I mean, so this, the book is specifically about West African, Arabic, Sufi, Madih poetry, Madih Nabawi, poetry and praise of the Prophet. So it's pretty specific. It's a particular region, particular language, and then a particular genre within that language. So But it happens to be by far the most popular form of Arabic poetry in West Africa, probably the most popular form of poetry in West Africa, even including the Europhone traditions of poetry. And so Madih poetry is basically praise poetry. And it comes from a long tradition extending into the pre-Islamic period. Madih was originally part of the kind of long qasida structure, which starts off with the poet in the nasib, lamenting the absence of the beloved at the beloved's campsite, the ruins of the beloved's campsite, and the passage of time and youth, the days gone by. And then the qasida, the second part of the qasida is called the rahil, which is the poet journeying in search of the beloved and fighting off dangers and fighting battles and overcoming obstacles. And then the end, the third part, the last part of the qasida traditionally is this madih, in which the poet praises a would-be patron or praises a the beloved or the beloved's tribe. And it's usually kind of in expectation of a gift, sometimes explicitly. You know, so I praise you, so you give me money or give me this or horse or give me, you know, give me something, give me status. But very quickly in the Islamic period, you get these poets who write poems in praise of the Prophet. So one of the most famous is the first Burda poem by Ka'b ibn Zuhair, Banat Su'ad, which is, he writes a poem along this traditional qasida structure and ends with him praising the Prophet and the Prophet's qualities in the community of Muslims around him. And he asks for the Prophet to forgive him because he had written some poems lampooning the Prophet before him. So the Prophet forgives him in the story and gives him his cloak, which is why it's known as the first poem, Burda poem, the poem of the cloak. And you have Hassan ibn Thabit and other poems praising the Prophet. So this Madih becomes its own genre in the Islamic period, with very famous poems by, probably the most famous being Busiri's Burda poem of the cloak. And in West Africa, and it's particularly in Sufi West Africa, this genre is really, really important because West African Sufism, whether it's the Tijaniyya or the Qadiriyya, the two main orders in the region, is very, very focused, is very prophet-focused. I mean, all Sufism is very prophet-focused, but the love of the Prophet, modeling the Prophet, and even a kind of mystical union with the Prophet called Fana fi Rasul, is regarded in the region as that's the goal of the Sufi practice of Muslim life, is annihilation in the Prophet and cultivating love for the Prophet. And it's emphasized everywhere in the Muslim world, but it's particularly strong in West Africa. And so Madih poetry is a particularly I think suitable vehicle for developing, expressing that kind of relationship of closeness, intimacy, love, and even annihilation identity with the Prophet. And that's how it's been used. In terms of poetry in general, I think poetry, it's interesting when you look at people who get classified as, or writers who get classified as mystical, quote unquote, in, you know, various traditions and literatures of the world, they tend to write in poetry or be very poetic. And I think it has something to do, at least in the Sufi tradition, they say the spiritual experiences and knowledge that they have resist description in ordinary language. And so you have to use poetic language. So it's like in earlier, the paper that kind of preceded this, I argue that, you know, if you have some experience that we don't share in common, like, you know, if, you know, you're trying to explain to me what durian tastes like and I've never had durian, the fruit. You know, you'd have to use poetic language. It's like this, it's kind of like that. You'd have to use similes and metaphors and so on and so forth. So poetic language seems particularly apt for Sufi expressions. For that reason, also the kind of Sufi cosmology in which, in a certain sense, everything is everything. Everything is contained in everything else. So you kind of have levels of reality in which everything is connected. Everything in the cosmos is connected to everything else. It's also a very kind of poetic vision of the cosmos, of language and the relationship between language and the cosmos. And I think that also lends itself to poetry. And then something that Dennis Macaulay has a good book on, Ibn Arabi's poetics, And Ibn Arabi actually describes the whole universe as a poem because it's all God's speech. All of the created world is God's speech, but it's ordered and it has certain order and repetition to it. So it's like meter and rhyme. And so the whole universe is a poem. And Ibn Arabi also explains that kind of poetry is a barzakh, a liminal reality that both unites and separates kind of silence and speech. So it's kind of halfway between music, just pure wordless music, and prose. And then so I took that and kind of dived into it a little bit. You even see it in the formal features of poetry, like the meter, the rhythm is kind of a barzakh between stillness and motion. The rhyme is a barzakh between one sound and many sounds. And so poetry has this kind of barzakhi liminal quality that in Sufi cosmology, that's what human beings are. Human beings are a barzakh between being and nothingness, especially the prophet. And so this kind of poetic speech seems particularly favored by Sufis for a number of reasons. I mean, some of them just historical, some of them having to do with their cosmology, with theories of language, and things like that. But it seems to be a particularly chosen vehicle for the expression and the encapsulation of spiritual states, ideas, knowledge, and things like that that otherwise resist ordinary discursive description. I think Ibn Arabi, there's another good article by Claude Adès called The Ship of Stone. Ibn Arabi called poetry the language of the saints, something like that. And for the West African Sufis, that's certainly the case, at least the ones with which I'm familiar.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And that of course is the other big kind of component that you draw this material from. So perhaps you could kind of help us understand a little bit about Sufism in West Africa. If I remember correctly, much of the poetry that you're translating is from Ibrahim Niass.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what do we need to know about, Sufism in West Africa, the Tijaniya in particular, Ibrahim Niass in particular, to really kind of understand what you're doing in the book?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the main things I'm trying to do is I was reading a lot of this poetry, but then also the author's own commentaries on their own poems and commentaries by their students on these poems to try to bring out, not just do a kind of literary analysis of the poetry from the outside, but try to understand how the authors, the poets, and the communities that recite and engage with this poetry, how they understand it. So Sufism in West Africa is interesting. There was a Pew Charitable Trust study done in, I think, 2014 or 2015 that found that Sufism is more popular in West Africa than any other region of the Muslim world. And there's some methodological problems with their study, but according to them, 92% of Senegalese Muslims identify as Sufi, identify as belonging to a tariqa. It's something like 37% in Ghana and Nigeria, 55% in Chad. So this is a region in the 21st century that's heavily Sufi influenced, if not Sufi dominated. And if you go a century or two back, it's even more so. Most of the founders of these major polities, pre-colonial polities, were Sufi scholars. So the founder of the Sokoto Caliphate, Uthman Danfodio, who have some, I think two of his poems here in the book, was a Qadiri Sheikh, and Al-Hajj Umar Tal, who founded the Tukulor Empire, was one of, it stretched from Senegal to Mali and Guinea in the mid-19th century, was a Tijani Sheikh. Amadou Bamba he had several initiations and then became the head of the what's now the Mouridia order in Senegal. And then going back even further than that, scholars like Ahmed Baba and Timbuktu and Mohamed Kashnawi called Dan Massaneh and these other scholars had Sufi affiliations and initiations and wrote works of Sufism. So there's always in West Africa's history is interesting because like a lot of places, pre-colonial Sufi orders were very active. What's kind of distinct about West Africa, it's not unique, but distinct is the way in which these Sufi orders and Sufi leaders in the 18th and 19th century gained a lot of political power and kind of set the tone of not only Islamic scholarship, but also political organization and the period right before colonization. And then there were all kinds of interesting interactions in the colonial period as well too, which in some cases actually strengthened some Sufi orders. You had people converting en masse to Islam and joining these Sufi orders as a kind of alternative social structure and hierarchy to the collapsing old order and as an alternative to the kind of new Europhone colonial order. So Sufism, for a number of interesting different reasons, was and continues to be very prominent in West Africa. Now, the particular form of Sufism, most popular order in West Africa is the Tijaniyya. It was founded by Sheikh Ahmed Tijani. It was an 18th century scholar, Saharan scholar, born in the middle of the Algerian desert. Studied in Fez, made Hajj, had all these interesting connections with Shuyukh and Sufis and scholars from around the world in Medina, and came back to North Africa. And legend is had a waking vision of the Prophet who instructed him to found this new order, the Tijaniyya, which spread like wildfire across the Sahara Desert, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and in the Sahel across the Sudan. And the Tijaniyya places a particular emphasis on prayers on the Prophet, on connection with the Prophet, and a lot of Tijani sheikhs claim to have waking visions of the Prophet, sometimes perpetually waking visions of the Prophet, and have discourse with the Prophet. And it's a very Prophet-centric form of Sufism, and the Tariqa, like a bunch of other movements at the time, took the name Tariqa Muhammadiyya, and I've emphasized this focus on Prophet Muhammad. The other main Sufi order in West Africa is the Qadiriyya, you know, which is widespread everywhere. West African Qadiris, though, like the Tijanis, also have a very kind of prophet-centric Sufism. So not only focus on the sunnah of the Prophet, following that in minute detail, but they also strongly emphasize the Hakikatul Muhammadiyya, the spiritual reality, logos-like spiritual reality of the Prophet, and having a connection with that. And dreams and waking visions of the Prophet play a really important role in this form of Sufism, as do prayers on the Prophet and poetry in praise of him.
And then, so Ibrahim Niass plays this kind of essential role, at least in the translations that you make. And I can't remember particularly if it was him or someone else, but I remember somebody that like the last 20 years of their writing career, they only wrote this type of poetry.
Yeah.
Was that him?
No, that's Sheikh Amadou Bamba.
Okay.
But Ibrahim Niass, he wrote, I think, 12 collections of poetry, which are almost entirely just Medea, poetry in praise of the Prophet.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit more about kind of in these specific Sufi orders, in the kind of everyday lived practice, how might this poetry kind of play a part within these orders and within daily lived realities?
So, I mean, what they play all kinds of in daily lived practice, you see it, people at naming ceremonies for children, people recite these poems. So, I mean, if you go in the houses of some shuyukh, they'll have someone, they'll have like a Quran reciter, and they'll have someone who recites the poetry of Sheikh Ibrahim if they're in his branch. Or if you if you're in a murid neighborhood, let's say in Dakar or Touba, you hear Sheikh Amadou Bamba's poems in praise of the Prophet blasting from speakers. Either people are playing recordings, or they're coming out of taxis, or people are sitting around in a circle reciting them, particularly on Thursday night, Friday night. So generally, people will get together in circles to recite their litanies, sometimes in the morning and especially in the evenings after work. And usually sometimes before, but often typically after these litanies, people will recite this poetry. Then I found out in Senegal and Nigeria and other places in West Africa as well too, especially in Sheikh Bernias's branch of the Tijaniyya, which, sorry, I forgot to talk about. It's called the Faida, and it's or the Flood. And it's a particularly popular branch of the Tijaniyya. It started in Senegal, Sheikh Bernias's Senegalese, but it's very, very popular in Nigeria, throughout the Sahel, over to Sudan and Ethiopia, and it's now traveled in the diaspora. It's popular in Europe and in the States. They've got big zawiyas in Atlanta and Detroit and in South Africa and other places too. But in this, the sheikhs will use Sheikh Bernias's poetry as a part of the program of tarbiyah, or spiritual training. So they'll actually assign disciples to recite poems for certain spiritual purposes. So certain poems will be recited in order to have a dream of the Prophet. Other poems will be recited and kind of explained to help explain different aspects of Sufi cosmology and different Sufi experiences to the Prophets. Not only to explain them, but to kind of provoke the realization or the experience of these realities in disciples. And then you have people who, you know, just have these poems on their cell phones and listen to them when they're working or driving or with their friends and hang out and talk about it. So it's, the poems are used in a wide variety of ways, from this kind of methodical, you know, formal spiritual practice to kind of more informal enjoyment. So they're used in a wide variety of ways.
One of the other things you do in the book, and you kind of talked a little bit about some of this, are the sources and the influences on this type of poetry. And of course, there's Islamic, you know, predecessors. But you also talk about kind of West African influences. So can you talk about the type of praise poetry that happens in West Africa? What are these kind of multiple strains that influence them?
Yeah, this was a particularly fun section for me to research and write, because there was this kind of colonial myth of Islam noir, that African Islam is, or Black Islam is, radically different from White Islam. It's kind of this racial thing. And so there's been a big reaction against that in the scholarship, to show that no, African Islam isn't somehow racially just like emotional and spiritual rather than intellectual and all these other silly racial things. But part of the thing that I think that's been sometimes missed in the pushback against the kind of racist colonial stereotypes is the actual important influence of pre-Islamic or non-Islamic African cultures and literary traditions, for example. So one of these is many, many traditions amongst a lot of the different ethno-linguistic groups of West Africa of praise poetry. So for myself, I remember, like, in Nigeria, when we would go to weddings and functions, you would have praise singers that would go around, and sometimes they would improvise praise songs in Yoruba for patrons, and then people would give them money. And there's a particular kind of, how do I describe in English, oriki. It's kind of like a praise epithet. It's a very poetic speech that every family has its own oriki. It kind of names your ancestors through these very poetic epithets. So it's like the elephants that trampled the palm tree and never gets burned by fire or something. And then you'll have this string of very poetic epithets that kind of tell you who you are and where you're from. And these praise poets will come up, and if they know your family and know who you are, they sing your oriki, and it makes you feel really good, and you give them some giving us some money. So I, you know, going to weddings and funerals and things like that. I grew up around these kind of things. And then in the Mandé region, and even broader, so kind of Senegal, Mauritania, Mali, Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso, Niger, they have this incredible jelly or griots, the French translation, tradition of praise singing, in which they'll sing praises of ancestors of people. So if you meet anyone who's or see a soccer player whose last name is Keita, that means they're a descendant of Sundiata, the mythical king of whose story was the inspiration for the Lion King. And so if you meet a Keita, the jelly will burst into the Sundiata song, and then the Keita will be obliged to give the jelly, the griot, some money for that as a kind of recompense for that. And in all of these different traditions, it's kind of understood you're not just flattering the person, but in a certain sense, you're evoking, you're calling forth their ancestors who are still within them. And I think there's a very similar thing going on in the Madih poetry as well too, because in this Sufi, the West African Sufi cosmology, they take the, you know, the verses of Quran, the prophet is closer to the believers than themselves, very literally. So that the prophet is really the heart of, or the core, or the essence of each and every person, really each and everything, but particularly people. And so that they're trying to evoke that. And then this, but this influence, aside from this kind of like bigger cosmological things, you can even see the influence in the technical formal features of the tradition. So one thing is, I think that's the common genre of, or different genres of praise poetry that existed, let's say pre-Islamically, or that were in non-Muslim or less Muslim, non-scholarly circles that were popular there. I think they also influenced and supported the popularity of Madih poetry. But as I said, they even influenced the form of it. So one of the most famous Madih poems and influential in the region was this poem by this Mauritanian scholar Ali Adali, 18th century Shadhili Sufi. And he says he was traveling in his commentary on his poem, Salatu Rabbi, he was traveling and he heard a group of Igawin, griots, singing this beautiful song. And he liked the melody so much that he said, I've got to write a poem praising the prophet with this melody. And so it's not in one of the standard meters of classical Arabic poetry, even though he wrote the poem in classical Arabic instead of Hassaniya Arabic, the kind of Arabic dialect of the region. It uses a meter and a melody from griot melodies and songs. And the same thing happens in the present day, 20th century, early 21st century, with this poet from Djene in Mali, Ko Yaro, who would take, he would listen to popular recordings on the radio of jelly music, of griot music from Mali's done a pretty good job supporting this music. So they have lots of national orchestras and bands and things like that. So he'd listen to songs that he really liked there. And then he would write out metrical structures based on the songs. And then he would compose his own maduhu, is what they call it in Djene, his own madih poems in classical Arabic, but to the meters of these jelly songs. And then another thing that you see happen in West Africa is that people who are from these praise poet families often become the performers of Madih poetry. So Uthman Danfodio, when he took over the Sokoto Caliphate, encouraged the Hausa and Fulani praise singers. He said, stop singing praises of men and sing the praises of God's beloved, the best of men. I mean, the kind of quote-unquote secular political praise, more political, more ancestral praise poetry tradition still continues. It's still very, very vibrant. But a lot of these singers added Madih poetry to their repertoires and added poems in praise of great Sufi saints along to the repertoire of praise of great mythical cultural heroes and ancestral figures and so on. So it's a really interesting influence, not only of the Arabic tradition on non-Arabic traditions, but also on the non-Arabic and non-Islamic traditions on the Arabic tradition as well.
Another section of the book, you talk about the various kind of functions or uses of these poems. And how they can serve as duas or dhikr or be part of this kind of hilya tradition. How do these poems kind of, how are they used as that? Do they, are their structures then different or, how does this all fit in?
Yeah. So, this was actually interestingly inspired partly by looking at the commentaries on the poems, partly by just hanging out and seeing how these poems were performed by people, but then also by, conversation I had with Hamza Stainton, who teaches up at McGill. He works on like Kashmiri, Hindu poetry, like Sanskrit poetry. And we noticed some interesting similarities, and he has a good book, Poetry as Prayer, and the different kind of ritual functions that poetry has. So that kind of inspired this organization of it. But yeah, so there are different structures and functions that you'll notice. And one poem can serve many of these different functions. So it's kind of a heuristic division. But a lot of these Madih poems will function as dua. So sometimes they're just explicitly just a versified dua for intercession. God, I love you, Prophet, so much. Please intercede for me. Or other times they'll even say the very act of composing a poem in praise of the Prophet is a request for intercession. So Yadali quotes this hadith that I haven't found elsewhere, but he says that the Prophet says, anyone who praises me in poetry, even with one verse, I will intercede for him on the day of judgment. And the Sheikh Amadou Bamba's poetry and Sheikh Ibrahim Yas's poetry are littered with references, as well as other poets and poems too, that my praise of the Prophet is my intercession. It's my happiness in the two worlds. It's the thing that is my request for spiritual elevation. It's this and that. So you have all of these explicit requests for spiritual success, for health, for protection from enemies, for happiness in this world and the next, and all these kinds of things. Even some poems, not necessarily strictly Madih poems, but there are a lot of poems and poetic prayers that were used, let's say, in French colonial occupation, to pray for God to relieve the Muslims of the French colonial occupation. And poems were recited as duas to, let's say, relieve illness as well too. So the famous story about Busiris, the 13th century or 14th century Egyptian poet or North African Egyptian poet who wrote the Borda, was that the story goes that he was sick and he composed the poem while he was sick. And when he finished, he had a dream and the Prophet put his cloak around him. He woke up with the cloak on him and he was cured of his paralysis or his disease. And then this kind of trope gets repeated numerous times throughout West African Sufi literature. So Hajju Martal wrote this incredible poetic feat in which he took a previously existing collection of 20 verse poems and did a deca stitch, a tashir of them. So he added 8 hemi stitches of his own to the two hemi stitches of each verse of this massive collection of poetry. And when he fell really ill, his disciples recited that over him to cure him, and they said it cured him. So the poetry often functions as a dua for, lifting illness, happiness, or all these other kinds of things. Sometimes it's explicit, sometimes it's more implicit. The poetry also functions a kind of this hilya tradition in which it describes the appearance and the character of the Prophet, and the purpose of that is to kind of provoke and evoke love and longing for the Prophet. And usually those are kind of almost a distinct subgenre on their own, where they really get into the descriptions of the physical attributes, the character of the Prophet. Usually Madih poetry bounces back and forth between the kind of historical Prophet and the prophetic reality, the Hakikatul Muhammadiyah. So you have this bouncing back and forth between, like, your light was the first light to emerge from God's light, and then down to, and you took care of orphans and patched your own sandals and did this and that. And the ones that are kind of on the more hilya side of things tend to focus more on the historical Prophet, although still connecting it to this kind of primordial prophetic light. And then often a lot of this poetry is performed and functions as a dhikr. So people will recite a verse or half a verse, and then it will be interspersed with recitations of the shahada, of Allah, 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 of other divine names, of other things. And it's repeated sometimes for hours and as a form of dhikr. And a lot of the poetry, particularly at its end, ends with salawat on the Prophet. And in fact, a lot of the poems really can just kind of be seen as poetic extensions of the salawat genre, the genre of invoking prayers on the Prophet.
So there's a lot to this book, and we've been jumping around. So I'm not sure if there's anything else you want to let listeners know before they go out and pick the book up.
I guess I think for me, one of the most important things I was trying to do in the book was to draw people's attention to and give people examples of that they could work with of African Arabic literature. Because a lot of scholars of Arabic literature tend to focus on the quote-unquote Arab world. And there's a lot of great Arabic literature that's being produced outside of these confines. So in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, in Central Asia, in West Africa, in East Africa. And also for Africanists, I wanted to kind of make more known and give like actual concrete examples that people could use and work with. Examples of African literature isn't just in European languages. It's also not just in, African language novels or things like that. There are traditions of African literature that go back very, very far in Arabic and in African languages. And so what else? So I just wanted to give to kind of make that intervention in the kind of fields of African literature and Islamic studies and Arabic studies as well, and to also try to understand the poetry as best I could, the way the poets and the reciters did, to kind of use the terminology and the categories and the theories of language and poetics that that I saw operating in the tradition. Because it's one thing to kind of come at it from the outside with whatever theories of poetics you may have, but it's another thing to try to get at it from the inside, and that's what I was really trying to do. I hope it was an enriching exercise. It was for me. I hope it will be for readers.
Yeah, it's a great book, and I'm glad it's at a price that's accessible as well. Before I let you go, I know you have another new book coming out shortly, and I'm sure you have things lined up after that. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the other things you have coming out or planned out ahead?
Oh, I also remembered one other thing I wanted to say to your previous question that I blanked on was another thing I wanted to do, because this was something I suffered from at first, was that there's a kind of prejudice. This is the devotional is separate from the literary and the intellectual. So when I first started working with like West African manuscripts, and I would see all this Madih poetry, I would kind of just skip over it because I'd be like, okay, it's devotional stuff. It's like, I get it. The Prophet's wonderful and you love him so much. And okay. And I feel really embarrassed that I did that now. I kind of had this prejudice, and I've seen it in a lot of the other work, from previous decades on West African Arabic and West African Islamic literature, that the devotional, something being devotional literature doesn't mean that it's not literary. It doesn't mean that it's not creative. Doesn't mean that it's not intellectual. Far from it. So a lot of these categories that we have and that we use, that we've inherited from our own academic traditions and the boundaries that they draw, don't necessarily apply when we look at other literatures and other literary cultures. As for the other stuff I'm working on now, so right now I'm trying to finish the copy edits on my next book, which was supposed to be my first book, but this one kind of lapped it. So it's called Deep Knowledge, Ways of Knowing in Ifa and Tijani Sufism, Two West African Intellectual Traditions. So what took me to Senegal and Nigeria to do this was the research for this book, which is a much bigger book, and it's a study of epistemology in Ifa, which is an indigenous Yoruba tradition, and Tijani Sufism. And that should be out, God willing, in October, if I can finish all the copy edits. And then I've started work on This may end up being another book, but I have a series of articles on Uthman Danfodio's grandson, Sheikh Dantafa, who's really interesting because he wrote works of falsafa in 19th century northern Nigeria. And that's very unique. We don't usually see anyone calling anything what they're doing, any scholars calling what they're doing falsafa in the Maghreb, you know, in the Islamic West, really after Ibn Khaldun or maybe even earlier, after the fall of Andalusia. So he's a really interesting Sufi and philosophical thinker that I've been working on. And the last thing that I've just started working on now is trying to put into conversation some Caribbean theorists and thinkers like Frantz Fanon and Sylvia Winter with and their kind of decolonial projects and ideas with West African Sufi decolonial thinkers and revolutionaries like Emir Abdelkader, Amadou Bamba, Amadou Hampate Ba, and Ibrahim Niass. There's a kind of interesting complementarity with these different figures that I'm trying to work out. So I have my plate full. I've got my hands full for a while.
Yeah, good luck. It all is very, very exciting stuff, though. So I look forward to reading all about it in the future.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and thank you for making the time to talk about the book.
Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. That was my conversation with Oludamini Ogonaike about poetry in praise of prophetic perfection, a study of West African Arabic Mahdi poetry and its precedents, published with Islamic Text Society in 2020. We hope you'll listen again to New Books in Islamic Studies.